content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the March 6, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing shows a bedroom. Uncle Sam is sleeping. He's got stuffed animals behind him, an elephant and a donkey. He's got an anguished look on his face. And in his dream bubble is a grinning Vladimir Putin. The title is The 2020 Nightmare. Will the Trump administration squelch intelligence about Putin's interference in the election? That's one of the main stories, but I think we're going to opt for the other one this week. We're actually going to start today's show with the editor's letter. He says, viruses, strictly speaking, are not alive. They are tiny sets of genes bundled within protein shells with one singular function, to replicate. Lacking cells or other common features of living organisms, viruses are parasitic zombies. They infect living cells, hijack the genetic machinery, and mass produce replicas of themselves. A single sneeze can release 100,000 viruses into the air. The common cold is a virus, and so are influenza, measles, HIV, and Ebola. The new coronavirus, COVID-19, has joined the list of humanity's viral scourges after apparently jumping species from its original host, bats. It has sickened more than 80,000 people, and infectious disease experts say it's coming to America. One way or another, it will affect all of our lives. As COVID-19 relentlessly advances, there is much scientists and doctors do not yet understand. Infection produces widely varying responses. Some people have no symptoms, but can still transmit the virus to others. A majority suffer only mild respiratory distress. Others become severely sick with flu-like aches and high fever and pneumonia. Deaths occur when the infections trigger an out-of-control immune response, creating a cytokine storm that inflames and shuts down the lungs. Scientists estimate a mortality rate of 2-3%. If there are major outbreaks in the U.S., authorities may discourage people from congregating in crowds and may temporarily shut schools and curtail travel. The economy could take a significant hit. COVID-19 may even have an unpredictable impact on the presidential race. Americans tend to overreact to such disruptions. Protected by our oceans and relative affluence, we expect to be exempt from problems affecting places like China and Italy. Now we face a mindless invader thousands of times smaller than a grain of sand, one that knows no national boundaries. COVID-19 will test our strength, our social cohesion, and our leaders. And that was from William Falk, the editor-in-chief. We're going to take one of the main stories that it may seem like old news because we're just past Super Tuesday when you'll hear this show, but it certainly applies. Moderates seek to stall Sanders' momentum. What happened? Panicked Democrats were hoping for a single centrist savior to emerge this week after Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' landslide victory in the Nevada caucus made him the undisputed frontrunner in the race. After Sanders' triumph, House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn of South Carolina moved to throw his considerable sway in his home state behind former Vice President Joe Biden ahead of this Saturday's primary, which Biden hopes to win with major African-American support and revive his campaign. "We know Joe," Clyburn said. "More importantly, Joe knows us." At a debate in Charleston, Sanders' moderate rival sought to slow his momentum, casting him as a far-left extremist whose praise for communist regimes and support for policies like Medicare for All would alienate vast swaths of the electorate. Senator Sanders believes in an inflexible ideological revolution that leaves out most Democrats, not to mention most Americans, said former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Sanders' victory in Nevada followed his first and second place finishes in New Hampshire and Iowa, and saw him win nearly 47% of the vote, or more than double that of his closest rival, Biden, who had 20.2%. Buttigieg finished third with 14.3%, and Senator Elizabeth Warren fourth with 9.7%. In victory, Sanders trumpeted the multi-generational, multiracial coalition that fueled his Nevada win, including surprising support of 53% among Hispanics and 27% among African Americans. "It's going to sweep the country," Sanders said. Centrist Democrats hoped that billionaire Michael Bloomberg could be the one to stop Sanders, faded after Bloomberg badly stumbled during a debate in Nevada. He seemed stunned and hesitant when Warren and other rivals attacked his stop-and-frisk policy as New York City mayor and brought up allegations of sexism by women employees of his company. In the South Carolina debate, Bloomberg trained his fire on Sanders, warning that nominating a socialist would guarantee President Trump's reelection and cost Democrats the House and state legislatures. "Then between gerrymandering and appointing judges for the next 20 or 30 years, we're going to live with this catastrophe," Bloomberg said. What the editorial said: "Democrats have no one to blame but themselves," said the Wall Street Journal. "For weeks, the candidates have largely given Sanders a pass during the debates, failing to challenge his extreme policies such as banning private health insurance and fracking, raising taxes on the middle class, and hiking federal spending by $60 trillion. If Sanders is the nominee, every down-ballot Democrat will be burdened with the socialist label." "It's far too early to panic," said the Tampa Bay Times. "Only three small states have voted so far, and the combined number of people who voted in these caucuses is smaller than even the turnout from a typical mid-sized city. Bloomberg hasn't even been on the ballot yet. Democrats should take a deep breath and see what voters decide on Super Tuesday, March 3rd, when more than a third of all delegates will be up for grabs." What the columnists said: "Sanders isn't winning primaries because of his specific policy proposals," said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. "What sets him apart from his more mainstream opponents is his animating belief that our political and economic system is unjust. Like Donald Trump in 2016 and the Tea Party in 2010, Sanders is running on anger at Washington's indifference to ordinary working people. To stop Sanders, all but one of the moderates must drop out of the race," said Gabrielle De Benedetti in NYMag.com. "But it won't happen. They're still clinging to the belief that they have a path to victory, however slim. The Democratic establishment and party giants like Barack Obama are not making an organized effort to shrink the field. Only a negative ad blitz by Bloomberg against Sanders might dent him badly enough to prevent the Vermont senator from winning a majority of delegates." The writers of those attack ads will have no shortage of material, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. Sanders was 38 when he joined the Socialist Workers' Party, which declared in 1980 that many of the American hostages in Iran were simply spies. He has admitted he was 39 when he received his first steady paycheck as mayor of Burlington, Vermont. At 44, he called for public ownership of oil companies, factories, utilities, and banks, and traveled to Nicaragua, where he took part in a rally which the crowd chanted, the Yankee will die. Just this week, he lauded Cuban dictator Fidel Castro for launching a massive literacy program after the revolution. If Sanders wins, Democrats can forget about Florida, which has 1.5 million Cuban refugees. A Sanders nomination would also be a disaster for Democrats' new fragile House majority, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. The party won 40 seats in the 2018 midterms by appealing to moderates, particularly older, college-educated, conservative-leaning women from the suburbs, sick of Trump's outrageous language and behavior. Good luck getting these crucial voters to vote for big tax increases, public health insurance, and admiration of Fidel Castro. The controversy of the week, titled Weinstein, is his conviction a turning point? Harvey Weinstein's many victims have finally got their Hollywood ending, said Maureen Callahan in NYPost.com. 2.5 years after published reports of sexual assault and harassment against the movie mogul launched the Me Too movement, a New York jury this week convicted Weinstein, 67, of third-degree rape and criminal sexual assault. Weinstein was acquitted on the more serious charges of first-degree rape and predatory sexual assault, but he'll spend at least 5 years in jail, and another rape trial is pending in Los Angeles. It's hard to overstate how consequential this is. Weinstein's humiliating trial and conviction puncture the absolute sense of impunity enjoyed by powerful predators, making it more likely women will report their abusers. Weinstein's journey from untouchable to incarcerated is a symbolic turning point, said Maura Donegan in TheGuardian.com, signaling our society's repudiation of the abuse that women have endured for millennia. Despite the verdict, the case demonstrated the extreme difficulty of prosecuting men for sexual assault, said Barbara Bradley Haggerty in TheAtlantic.com. More than 90 women came forward with allegations against Weinstein. Yet, thanks to statutes of limitations and the inherent challenge of proving that a sexual encounter wasn't consensual, only two of the cases made it to trial, those of actress Jessica Mann and producer Miriam Haley. There, as our system demands, Weinstein's victims had to relive their intimate trauma in a public setting. While defense lawyers cataloged each woman's sexual history and personal flaws and portrayed her as a liar happy to trade sex for career success. The trial was a painful reminder of why only 25% of rapes are ever even reported, and only 0.05% of those who commit sexual violence are ever convicted. The trial saw one crucial breakthrough that could change those statistics, said Jeffrey Abramson in the Los Angeles Times. Weinstein's defense team showed that both women stayed friendly with him after their alleged assaults and even had consensual sex with him. Historically, this kind of evidence has guaranteed acquittal. But the prosecution's expert witnesses helped jurors understand how rapists overwhelm their victims psychologically as well as physically, and that trying to normalize relations with one's attacker is common behavior for traumatized women seeking to rebuild their lives after an assault. These are nuances that feminists have tried to explain for decades, said Alyssa Rosenberg in WashingtonPost.com. For a jury of Weinstein's peers to grasp them points to a significant cultural shift in the understanding of sexual violence. But when does that shift become an overcorrection, asks Eddie Scari in WashingtonExaminer.com. Weinstein got what was coming to him, but the Me Too movement has also wreaked a lot of havoc. In workplaces and on college campuses, we've created a climate where claims have become facts, and any woman feeling simple regret over a consensual encounter now has the cultural and legal tools to ruin a man's reputation. "Spare me," said Rebecca Solnit in the New York Times. "Every day, women worldwide still live under a mortal threat of gender violence. The Weinstein verdict won't change that, but you'll forgive us for celebrating the news that there are people willing to listen to women now, and sometimes what we say has consequences." Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for timeless classics. After President Trump complained at a rally in Colorado that a film from South Korea, Parasite, won the 2020 Academy Award for Best Picture. "Can we get Gone with the Wind back, please?" Trump asked, referring to the 1939 film that caricatures slaves as happy and simple-minded. It was a good week for extra pounds. After new research from Cornell University found that overweight men have greater perceived leadership potential in the workplace because of the big man stereotype. The findings, researchers cautioned, do not apply to women. And it was a good week for potty mouths. With the formal repeal of Virginia's 1792 ban on profane swearing, legislators, however, kept a prohibition on public spitting. "Spitting is yucky," one lawmaker explained. But it was a bad week for modern fairy tales. After armed robbers who made off with more than $320,000 worth in opioid pills from a Florida pharmacy were arrested by police who simply followed the breadcrumb-like trail of empty pill bottles thrown from the windows of their getaway car. It was a bad week for trolling after Pope Francis called on Catholics to give up insulting people on social media for Lent and pray instead of wasting time with useless words, gossip, rumors, tittle-tattle. Finally, it was a bad week for sexters with the launch in Japan of the Tone E20 smartphone. Retailing for a teen-friendly $180, the Tone E20 features an algorithm that disables the camera if the user is attempting to take a nude self-portrait and flashes the message, "Photo not taken due to inappropriate content." We're on the briefing page now, titled "The Growing Viral Threat." Infectious disease experts warn that it's inevitable that a virus will jump from animals to humans and kill tens of millions. Why are experts worried? Picture a new viral disease like the Wuhan coronavirus, now called COVID-19, that passes easily from person to person and spreads rapidly around the globe. But unlike COVID-19, which kills perhaps 2 or 3% of its victim, this virus kills 20% of those infected, or 40%. It might sound like a disaster movie premise, and in fact it was in 2011's Contagion, but viral disease experts are in wide agreement that such a pandemic is coming and that it will inflict unimaginable devastation. The only question is when it will hit. Last September, the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board, GPMB, a group convened in 2018 by the World Bank and the World Health Organization, warned of a very real threat of a pandemic that would kill 50 million to 80 million people, cost $3 trillion, and create widespread havoc, instability, and insecurity. We need only look to the recent past to see how dire things can get. The Spanish flu of 1918 killed between 50 million and 100 million, including 675,000 Americans, or about 3% of the global population. Where would such a virus come from? The most likely scenario is a pathogen that jumps from animals to humans and can spread through the air. The outbreak of COVID-19 was traced to a live animal market in Wuhan, China, where a bat virus appears to have added some genetic material from a soldier fish. Many viral diseases have been traced to animals, including HIV, which originated in chimpanzees, MERS, camels, SARS, probably bats and civet cats, and Ebola, unknown but probably bats. Last year, researchers at Johns Hopkins ran a simulation of a hypothetical coronavirus emerging from a Brazilian pig farm. The result was 65 million dead within 18 months. Another concern is a familiar, very deadly virus that mutates, allowing it to spread more easily. The avian flu H5N1, for example, has proven highly lethal but not very communicable so far. The intentional or accidental release of a man-made pathogen is another threat. New genetic engineering tools have made them far easier to create. A laptop captured from ISIS in 2014 contained instructions on how to weaponize plague bacteria. Why is this more of a problem now? Human population growth. People are encroaching on previously wild areas where unknown viruses and bacteria lurk in animals. Those who become infected carry the pathogens back to densely packed cities where disease is easily spread. The 1998 emergence of the Nipah virus, for example, was linked to deforestation in Malaysia that displaced fruit bats and put them near pig farms. Pigs became infected and the virus then spread to farm workers. In the past 50 years, more than 300 pathogens have emerged or reemerged, including Zika and yellow fever. At the same time, climate change has enabled insects and animals that carry disease to expand their habitats to new regions. Human migratory patterns are a factor as well. The surge in international travel allows viruses to spread around the globe quickly. We've created an interconnected, dynamically changing world that provides innumerable opportunities to microbes, said Richard Hatchett of the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. If there's weakness anywhere, there's weakness everywhere. Are we prepared for a major pandemic? Not at all. A report released last October by the Global Health Security Index found glaring gaps in readiness. Out of 195 countries surveyed, not one was judged fully prepared to handle a major event. In the U.S., under President Trump, the federal budgets for both research and response preparation have been cut. The National Security Council's Global Health Security Unit has been disbanded, and the White House official in charge of pandemic response left his job in 2018 and has not yet been replaced. We're caught in a cycle of panic and neglect, World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said. We throw money at an outbreak, and when it's over, we forget about it and do nothing to prevent the next one. What needs to be done? Experts say the U.S. and other countries need to spend vastly more money on pandemic preparedness. We need to develop better diagnostic tools, stockpile drugs and vaccines, and fund research into new treatments and vaccine technologies. Above all, there needs to be an international effort to improve sanitation, medical care, and response capability in poorer countries where new diseases are most likely to arise and spread. All of this requires a major change in mindset, say experts. The world needs to prepare for pandemics the same way it prepares for war, said Microsoft founder Bill Gates, who's invested tens of millions in viral disease research. Humanity's biggest threat, he said, is not missiles, but microbes. Time to read a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. First up, why VP choice will be critical. The vice presidency has miraculously become Washington's second most desirable job, said Jack Schaefer. Instead of standing silently behind the president for 4 years, withering away in a political dead end, the next VP has a significant chance of becoming president before the 2020 term ends. I'm not suggesting the four leading contenders for the top job, Donald Trump, 73, Bernie Sanders, 78, Michael Bloomberg, 78, and Joe Biden, 77, are likely to croak tomorrow, but both parties must take the actuarial odds seriously. Trump is clinically obese, eats poorly, had a mysterious rushed visit to the hospital in November, and has provided only partial medical records. Sanders recently had an onstage heart attack and refuses to release his records. Biden had two life-threatening aneurysms in 1988 that required brain surgery to correct. Bloomberg had two stents inserted in his heart 2 decades ago. Faced with the high likelihood of nominating a geezer, the Democrats can't pick a running mate just to satisfy the geographic, gender, and ethnic needs of the ticket. They need someone, maybe Stacey Abrams, 46, the rising star from Georgia, who could handle a promotion by death. Making corruption a norm. Why did President Trump last week pardon a rogues gallery of white-collar criminals, asks Joel Stein. Many people assume he commuted former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich's sentence and pardoned junk bond king Michael Milliken, tax cheat Bernard Carrick, and others simply because they were friends of friends or because he owed them a favor. But in Trump's worldview, cheating is irrelevant, and the white-collar crooks he pardoned had been unfairly persecuted for doing what everyone else does. If corrupt politicians land in jail, he thinks, it's only because corrupt politicians on the opposing side are picking on them for their own gain. Indeed, Blagojevich is calling himself a political prisoner, even though he was caught, among other crimes, demanding that the CEO of a children's hospital give his campaign $50,000 or see its public funding cut off. Sadly, 75% of Americans also believe government corruption is widespread, even though international agencies rate us among the least corrupt countries. It's clear who benefits from accepting corruption as normal and inevitable: the strong men trampling democracy around the globe like Trump. If everyone is corrupt, you go with the toughest corrupt guy on your team. This is from Switzerland. The Swiss roll in a global spy game. Switzerland's role in one of the largest espionage operations in history has been revealed, said Thomas Nellwolf, and the country is reeling. From 1970 into the 2000s, the Swiss security technology Crypto AG sold encryption machines to more than 120 nations. But all along, the firm was secretly owned and controlled by America's CIA and its German equivalent, the BND. The spy agencies had deliberately rigged the machines, allowing them to read the secret messages sent by friends and foes. For the CIA, it was the intelligence coup of the century. The encryption machines reportedly let the Americans eavesdrop on Iran during the 1979 hostage crisis and supply Britain with intelligence about Argentina during the 1982 Falklands War. This brazen operation was possible because the Americans and Germans could hide behind Switzerland's neutrality and good name. The worst part? The Swiss government knew all along. Its own equipment was never tampered with, but it failed to stop the spy scheme. The story came out only because of the efforts of a German reporter. Switzerland must immediately investigate this scandal with radical transparency, disclosing everything it finds and prosecuting officials who violated the law. If we don't, no country that was duped will trust us again. And we'll just roll right on to our feature article, The Last Word. This week titled, Generation Q. An elaborate conspiracy theory from the darkest corners of the internet is spreading to the mainstream, said Mike McIntyre and Kevin Roos in the New York Times. Why do people believe in QAnon? That's capital Q-A-N-O-N. A city council member in California took the dais and quoted from QAnon, a pro-Trump conspiracy theory about deep state traitors plotting against the president, concluding her remarks, God bless Q. A man spouting QAnon beliefs about child sex trafficking swung a crowbar inside a historic Catholic chapel in Arizona, damaging the altar and then fleeing before he was arrested. And outside a Trump campaign rally in Florida, people in Q t-shirts stopped by a tent to hear outlandish tales of Democrats secretly torturing and killing children to extract a life-extending chemical from their blood. What began online more than 2 years ago as an intricate if baseless conspiracy theory that quickly attracted thousands of followers has since found footholds in the offline world. QAnon has surfaced in political campaigns, criminal cases, merchandising, and at least one college class. Last month, hundreds of QAnon enthusiasts gathered in a Tampa park to listen to speakers and pick up literature. And in England, a supporter of President Donald Trump and Brexit leader Nigel Farage raised a Q flag over a Cornish castle. Most recently, the botched Iowa Democratic caucuses and the coronavirus outbreak have provided fodder for conspiracy mongering. QAnon fans shared groundless theories online linking liberal billionaire George Soros to technological problems that hobbled the caucuses and passed around bogus and potentially dangerous treatments for the virus. About a dozen candidates for public office in the United States have promoted or dabbled in QAnon, and its adherents have been arrested in at least seven episodes, including a murder in New York and an armed standoff with police near Hoover Dam. The FBI cited QAnon in an intelligence bulletin last May about the potential for violence motivated by fringe political conspiracy theories. Matthew Lusk, who is running unopposed in the Republican primary for a Florida congressional seat and who openly embraces QAnon, said in an email that its anonymous creator is a patriot who brings what the fake news will not touch without slanting. As for the theory's more extreme elements, Lusk said he was uncertain whether there really was a pedophile ring associated with the deep state. That being said, he added, I do believe there is a group in Brussels, Belgium, that do eat aborted babies. The seepage of conspiracy theorizing from the digital fever swamps into life offline is one of the more unsettling developments of the Trump era, in which the president has relentlessly pushed groundless conspiracy theories to reshape political narratives to his liking. In promoting fringe ideas about deep state schemes, Trump has at times elevated and encouraged QAnon followers, recirculating their posts on Twitter, posing with one for a photograph in the Oval Office, inviting some to a White House social media summit, Recently, during a day-long Twitter binge, Trump retweeted more than 20 posts from accounts that had trafficked in QAnon material. QAnon began in October 2017 when a pseudonymous user of online message boards, of online message board 4chan, started writing cryptic posts under the name Q Clearance Patriot. The person claimed to be a high-ranking official privy to top-secret information from Trump's inner circle. Over 2 years and more than 3,500 posts, Q, whose identity has never been determined, has unspooled a sprawling conspiracy narrative that claims, among other things, that Trump was recruited by the military to run for office in order to break up a global cabal of pedophiles, and that special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation would end with prominent Democrats being imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay. The anonymous post subsequently moved to 8chan, where they remained until August, when that site was taken offline after the El Paso, Texas mass shooting. They now live on 8kun, K-U-N, a new website built by 8chan's owner. Some QAnon fans are hardened conspiracy buffs who previously believed other fringe theories, such as the bogus claim that the September 11th terrorist attacks were an inside job. But many QAnon adherents are everyday Americans who have found in Q's messages a source of partisan energy, affirmation of their suspicions about powerful institutions, or a feeling of having special knowledge. Some are older adults who discovered the theory through partisan Facebook groups or Twitter threads and were drawn in by the movement's promises of inside information from the White House. Some QAnon devotees even believe that Trump posts himself under the code name Q+. Others are seduced by the movement's wild, often violent fantasies, including claims that Hollywood celebrities are part of a satanic child trafficking ring. In online chat rooms, Facebook groups, and Twitter threads, QAnon followers discuss the hidden messages and symbols they believe to be exposed in Q's posts or drops. For example, because Q is the 17th letter of the alphabet, a reference by Trump to the number 17 is seen as a possible signal of his support for them. They watch Patriot's Soapbox, a YouTube call-in show devoted to coverage of QAnon and other niche media projects that have popped up to fill the demand for Q-related content. Reddit barred a cluster of QAnon groups from its platform in 2018 after a spate of violent threats from members, and Apple pulled a popular QAnon app from its app store. But other social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, still host large amounts of QAnon content. In general, these platforms do not prohibit conspiracy theories unless their adherents break other rules, such as policies against hate speech or targeted harassment. The frequent introduction of new symbols and arcane plot points to dissect and decipher has given QAnon the feel of a theological study group or a massive multiplayer online game. In interviews, several adherents described QAnon as a lifestyle or a religion, and said it had become their primary source of political news and analysis. It's more of a cult than other conspiracy theories, said Joseph Yushinki, a political science professor at the University of Miami who studies fringe beliefs. QAnon is not just an idea, it's an ongoing thing that people can sort of get into and follow along with that keeps them entertained. With its core belief that the president is heroically battling entrenched evildoers, QAnon may be the ultimate manifestation of Trump-inspired conspiracy mongering. From the start, it was inexorably bound up with Make America Great Again communities online. The New York Times found last year that some 23,000 of Trump's Twitter followers had QAnon references in their profiles. But QAnon has steadily migrated offline to Trump campaign rallies, where dozens of supporters can be found with Q paraphernalia, K carrying signs and commiserating about the theory. In recent months, QAnon adherents have complained that security officials keep people from bringing their gear into rallies. The campaign said it permitted only approved signs and licensed merchandise at its events. Harry Formanek, a 65-year-old retiree who attended Trump's Florida rally in November wearing a QAnon t-shirt, said he learned about the theory after hearing allegations that top Democrats were running a child sex ring out of a Washington pizza parlor, the hoax known as Pizzagate, which was something of a precursor to QAnon. Now, he said, he spends roughly an hour a day on QAnon-related websites and believes, among other things, that Trump signals his support with Q-shaped hand gestures during public appearances. "My friends think I'm crazy," Formanek said. "I mean, the proofs are just undeniable." With its growth in popularity, QAnon's tangible presence is not limited to clothes, bumper stickers, and campaign signs, all of which can be found for sale on Amazon and at other retailers. The theory also showed up at Mesa Community College in Arizona, where an adjunct professor of English, Douglas Belmore, began working it into classroom lectures. He was fired last summer after students complained. Belmore announced his dismissal on Twitter, saying, "Why aren't more professors, teachers, cops, pastors, and woke Americans everywhere not talking about this?" Later he tweeted, "I pray that you see the truth and POTUS and Q and their war against the trafficking of children," and posted a video clip of Trump at a rally pointing to a baby wearing a Q onesie. On the campaign trail during the past 2 years, at least six Republican congressional candidates, as well as several state and local politicians, have signaled some level of interest in QAnon. Danielle Stella, a Republican congressional candidate in Minnesota, whose campaign's Twitter account has favored QAnon material and used a QAnon-related hashtag, was suspended from the platform in November after suggesting that the Democratic incumbent Ilhan Omar be hanged for treason. In an email responding to questions about her position on QAnon, Stella said through a campaign aide, "The decision to side with Twitter regarding my suspension for advocating for the enforcement of federal code proves that the New York Times and Twitter will always side with and fight to protect terrorists, traitors, pedophiles, and rapists." In San Juan Capistrano, California, Pam Patterson, a city council member, invoked QAnon in her farewell speech to the body in December 2018, reciting a Q posting as if it were scripture. To quote Q number 2436, she said, "For far too long, we have been silent and allowed our bands of strength that we once formed to defend freedom and liberty to deteriorate. We became divided. We became weak. We elected traitors to govern us." And in Montana, an elected Justice of the Peace, Michael Swingley, was reprimanded in November by a state judicial board for using his official email account to send an angry message to a journalist who had written an article skeptical of QAnon. Swingley wrote that regardless of whether Q is real, patriots were uniting because of it, and your world of fake news and liberal agendas that give away our country to foreigners and protect the Clintons and Obamas is coming to an end. Beyond the mainstreaming of QAnon in certain Republican circles, a bigger concern for researchers who track conspiracy theories is the potential for violence by unstable individuals who fall under its sway, particularly in the fraught political climate of the 2020 election. In its intelligence bulletin identifying QAnon as a potential domestic terror threat, the FBI warned that partisan conspiracy mongering in the United States was being exacerbated by the uncovering of real conspiracies or cover-ups by political leaders. Social media was serving as an incubator for groundless theories and inspiring followers to take action, it said. Although conspiracy-driven crime and violence is not a new phenomenon, the bulletin said, Today's information environment has changed the way conspiracy theories develop, spread, and evolve. Yushinsky said that because some people with a conspiracy mindset are willing to entertain political violence, it was perhaps inevitable that as QAnon attracted a bigger following, it would eventually come to include a dangerous, if tiny, subset of adherents. Once you reach a threshold of people, he said, that particular apple is going to show up in the barrel. A version of this article originally appeared in the New York Times. One of the obituaries this week. The hidden figure who put astronauts in space. Katherine Johnson, 1918 to 2020. Katherine Johnson liked to say that she joined the space program when computers wore skirts. She was one of several hundred women who performed complex calculations for NASA's engineers who, unlike Johnson, were white and male, using little more than slide rules and pencils. Possessing a fine mathematical mind, Johnson became the first black member of the agency's elite flight research division. There, she calculated the trajectory for the 1961 rocket launch that made Alan Shepard the first American in space, and the following year helped John Glenn become the first American to orbit the Earth. In 1969, her math got Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin to the moon and back. Yet Johnson's contributions went largely unheralded until her story and that of other black computers was told in the hit 2016 movie Hidden Figures. She seemed indifferent to the overdue attention. "I was just doing my job," Johnson said in 2017. "They needed information, and I had it." She was born in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, to a teacher mother and a farmer father, said the Washington Post. A math prodigy, Johnson recalled counting everything as a child. The steps to the road, the steps up to the church, the number of dishes and silverware I washed. Her hometown's segregated school system ended at age 12 for black children. So Johnson's mother took the kids 125 miles to Institute, West Virginia, where Johnson graduated high school at 14. She entered West Virginia State the next year, but after graduating found there were few opportunities for black female teenage mathematicians, said the New York Times. She worked as a school teacher until 1952 when she heard that Langley Research Center in Virginia, then run by NASA's predecessor agency, was hiring black female, quote, computers. Johnson and her black colleagues were told to use separate offices and bathrooms from their white counterparts until the birth of NASA in 1958. Despite such racist policies, Johnson thrived at the research facility and became a vital part of its operation. Glenn refused to fly his 1962 mission until Johnson verified a trajectory produced by an electronic computer. "If she says they're good," he said, "then I'm ready to go." Johnson would spend 33 years at Langley, and in 2015 was awarded the Medal of Freedom by President Barack Obama. Her formulas are still in use today. "If we go back to the moon or to Mars," said NASA's chief historian Bill Berry, "we'll be using her math." We'll flip on over to the health and science page. A short piece called A Sudan-Sized Turtle. Paleontologists have unearthed the remnants of a colossal turtle that patrolled northern South America some 10 million years ago. The Stupendimus geographicus grew up to 13 feet long and weighed 1.25 tons and inhabited a giant wetland that once covered the region. These creatures were built for battle, reports Reuters.com. Fossils dug up in Colombia's Tatacoa Desert and Venezuela's Urumaco region, including a 9.5-foot-long shell, the biggest ever found, show that males had front-facing horns on their shells that they may have used to tussle with other males over mates. Some Stupendimus fossils have bite marks and puncture bones. Punctured bones, evidence of skirmishes with giant crocodilians. The enormous turtle's diet was diverse, including small animals, fish, caimans, snakes, as well as mollusks and vegetation, said lead researcher Edwin Cadena from the Universidad del Rosario in Colombia. The turtles died out about 5 million years ago after the formation of the Andes dried out their watery habitat. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page. We've got an article here called Nuclear Families, the Problem, Not the Solution. For the first two centuries of America's existence, we were a nation of big, sprawling, extended families, said David Brooks in TheAtlantic.com. People were embedded in a supporting web of aunts, uncles, cousins, siblings, and grandparents who shared burdens and could step in and care for a child when a mom or dad was not available. Such multi-generational extended families helped parents, socialized young men, and grounded seniors, giving people's lives meaning. But over the 20th century, as farming waned and people chased the American dream to cities, they began living far from kin and nuclear families, a married mom and dad and their children. That worked for a time, but as our society has embraced self-fulfillment, autonomy, and privacy as ideals, the nuclear family has turned into a catastrophe. Kids are growing up in fragile family units that often crumble into single-parent homes. Working parents must pay people to perform child-rearing tasks that once were handled by kin. Seniors, meanwhile, often spend their final years alone. It's time to find better ways to live together. Easier said than done, said W. Bradford Wilcox and Hal Boyd, also in TheAtlantic.com. While the alternatives that Brooks offers up, communal living arrangements and so-called forged families of non-biological kin, have their merits, research has repeatedly proved that a nuclear family headed by two loving married parents remains the most stable and safe environment for raising children. The social ills that Brooks blames on the nuclear family, drug epidemics, rising rates of suicide, depression, and income inequality, are actually the awful consequence of its collapse, said Mona Charon in TheBulwark.com. In 1960, 77.5% of children lived in nuclear families. Today, that figure has fallen to 48%. We need to revive, not give up on, nuclear families. Society has changed too much for that to be possible, said Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post. Social conservatives can't magically erase geographic mobility, the need and desire of women to work, or high divorce rates. As Brooks points out, progressives also have no answers. They're so fixated on freedom and individuality that they can't concede the high cost of family breakdown and leaving so many kids and adults on their own. This is a prosperous age, but it is filled with bitterness and contradictions. We'll move into a few of the short notes, starting with the agency that oversees military communications for the White House has been the victim of cyber attack. The Defense Information Systems Agency, DISA, which is responsible for military cybersecurity, had its computers hacked, exposing 200,000 people's personal data. Pentagon officials would not say whether the cyber attack had been traced to its source. Based on the total cost of President Trump's golf outings to taxpayers, he is the country's 10th highest paid athlete. Taxpayers have paid about $152 million for Trump's golf trips, or roughly $50.6 million a year, records show. The number one player in the world, Rory McIlroy, has been paid $12 million to play over the past 2 years. Over 90% of plastic waste in the U.S. is not recycled and winds up in an incinerator or a landfill. 8 of the 10 most commonly polluted plastic items are currently unrecyclable, according to sponsors of a bill introduced in Congress that would make companies responsible for the waste they generate. Over on the poll watch, we see that 61% of Americans say they are better off now than they were 3 years ago, the highest percentage when an incumbent was running in a presidential election dating back to 1992. And we'll finish with a short quote from British journalist Godfrey Hodgkins, who says, "Americans love change, but they hate to be changed." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138.